Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Tennis Weekly with Joel, Kim and Chris. On today's Tour Catch-Up,
Iga and Coco upset in Dubai,
Alcaraz injury concerns grow in Rio,
and Jasmine Paolini wins the biggest title of her career.
Kim, Chris, today is the 26th of February and we are here to catch up on the week in tennis at Tennis Weekly HQ. The Middle Eastern swing is over for the WTA Tour. The Golden Swing is coming to an end for the ATP Tour and we are looking forward to the Sunshine Double in the United States.
We are indeed. Lots of swings and going on to a double now, it seems.
Is it the Sunshine Swing? Sunshine Swing? Sunshine Double Swing?
I mean, Sunshine Swing also sounds like a cocktail. I always think the Sunshine Double does. And I think it evokes fruity, light, playful, sunny vibes, which is always a good thing.
A Sunshine Treble sounds a little bit too much, right? That's a strong drink.
Yeah, three shots of...
tequila, tequila sunrise, maybe? Something like that, it could be.
I'll leave the shots to you guys. I know Joel, I mean, I don't know what's in a woo-woo, but...
It's got to be something.
You know, I'm a Hugo girl, as you know. but yeah, we do have that to look forward to, but we've got plenty to catch up on before we go over to the States for the start of the Sunshine Double Swing. What's been happening in the world the last week? I think there's been quite a few exciting, fun things before we get into the actual results, hasn't there?
Yeah, I've got Kim and Chris. The Instagram photo that broke social media is, of course, Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal spontaneously on a plane together. Miraculously, I don't know how this happens, but they booked themselves on the same flight and they took a selfie together. 1.1 million likes later, it has had the tennis world up in arms.
Has that got more likes than that Bradley Cooper selfie from the Oscars?
It's a lot of likes, isn't it?
From a few years ago. Or is it less popular than that? But yeah, I mean, is it a private jet or is it a regular jet. Airline?
That's what surprised me. We did have a phase where we were very into the airline sort of activity of players and what their flights were. And this is what's baffling about this. Who would have thought that they wouldn't be in a private jet? Or between them, they could have a private jet, surely.
Is it an environmental thing, maybe?
Oh, it could be.
I do love how in the selfie, there is a guy in the background just sort of minding his own business with headphones on, probably just sort of just unassumingly watching a film or some TV. And he's now in this selfie that has kind of exploded on the internet.
I hope he's not a tennis fan, because that would be extra funny. Because I saw some captions that said like 43 Grand Slams between these three on the flight. And obviously it's like 0-20-23-24.
I bet his friends and family are loving it if they've seen it, if they're one of the 1.1 million people. I mean, the other player that has a lot of Grand Slams, you know, that's not in that photo is Roger Federer, and he's out in Thailand at the moment, so he's certainly not on a plane with Novak and Rafa. He's out in Thailand. I assume he's just on holiday because he's been posting videos and photos of himself on a boat.
It's not part two of that Trevor Noah travel documentary, is it?
Oh, well,
the Swiss
I don't
tourist
know.
Board
be.
For Thailand.
I can see it now.
What I loved, though, is we talked about this a few episodes ago, but Federer put up the first kind of, you know, reel of images and videos, and he had Ellie Goulding Still Falling For You as his music of choice. So clearly he is a massive Ellie Goulding fan. That must be why she was the one chosen for his retirement at the Laver Cup.
We were very confused at the time. I think we tried to figure out what song it was. And I never thought that we'd be seeing sort of Roger Federer in his sort of pointed straw hat with the caption floating through Thailand set to the sounds of Ellie Goulding still falling from you from the Bridget Jones soundtrack.
I have been on an Ellie Goulding binge over the last week or so, so I can totally see why he wants a bit more of Ellie Goulding's music in his life. Banger after banger after banger.
Maybe for Tennis Weekly, we should try using that for our reels. Mm. You know, if you give us a suggestion.
Maybe. But keep it coming, because I really like Roger Federer's holiday snapshots on Instagram. I'm loving them myself.
I would arguably say, given the weather in Thailand, it looks like from the photos, maybe, I mean, if I was there, the Ellie Goulding song I would have chosen would have been Burn.
Mm. Has he got his sun cream, or is he an after sun kind of guy? Who knows?
I'd hope both, because, you know, skincare.
Yes, I'm sure he's got only the best for Roger, I'm sure.
Looking so young, yeah. I'm sure he's got top-of-the-range Swiss skincare. Oh, that's a bit of a tongue twister. Swiss skincare. Say that many times quickly. But Joel, no, Chris, what's been your kind of fun, playful thing from the last week?
Well, going from a play with slightly less Grand Slams, which I think is a bit unfortunate, but for Daniel Medvedev, he's actually hired someone else to his camp, and I just thought I saw this wonderful thing which said that he's now hired Gilles Simon, who does not have a job title. He's keeping his same coach as his main coach, but he will be traveling less. So there's a new member to the camp, and it is former player, former French number one, Gilles Simon. And he said that Medvedev gave him a list of 16 players he doesn't like to play, and I wrote 16 tactics to face these players. And I thought, honestly, that's wonderful. But I also thought, who are these 16 players? So I thought I'd put you on the spot and think, who would be on Medvedev's 16 players he doesn't like playing against? I think maybe a Mannarino. Surely no one likes playing against a Mannarino, but...
I mean, the obvious, I guess, Djokovic, Rafa...
Djokovic could be a
Roger.
Good one. Roger... Well, he did very
what
well.
Tactics,
well, Roger's irrelevant now, I suppose. Tactics.
What tactic would you give for Novak Djokovic?
Just... Oh, I don't know. Get him to play loads
of overheads. Yeah, who knows?
But he's got. Hope
for the best.
Yeah, for the best. I just looked this up, actually. Not a bad head-to-head. It is 2-0 to Djokovic over Gilles Simon, but every single match went to either five sets or three sets of the best of three format. So maybe someone, he's got more tactics under his belt than you think, because you wouldn't have thought they would have been as close as that.
I definitely think Stefanos Tsitsipas is on that list. And I think the tactic is clear and simple. Just play it to a single-handed backhand.
I mean, don't employ Gilles Simon for that. Just get Joel to tell you.
Yeah, I know.
Listen to the podcast.
I can give you
much
tactics.
Cheaper.
Yes, I give you tactics all week.
He's joined the Medvedev camp.
I thought it was going to be a hearsay reference there. I thought you were going to say pure and simple, not clean and simple.
That will be what our reels will be set to, hearsay, pure and simple.
Yeah, pure and simple going to be there. Well, let's go to the tennis that was last week. We had the Dubai WTA 1000 event. Did we have a Swiatek or a Coco Gauff or a Sabalenka winning? No, we did not. We had Jasmine Paolini winning the event. Obvious choice for the win. I mean, Jasmine Paolini against Anna Kalinskaya in the final.
We all had that. We all had that, didn't we?
Oh, nailed down in our predictions.
No brainer.
4-6, 7-5, 7-5. Quite a dramatic final, really. And Jasmine Paolini comes out on top. Chris, talk us through Jasmine Paolini as a WTA 1000 champion.
Well, firstly, it definitely was not on my bingo card. Did not see this happening because, I mean, she had a pretty good Australian Open reaching the fourth round before she actually went out to Kalinskaya. So she definitely has been kind of upping her game. But I mean, a 1000 title is a really big leap. I think previously this is her, I believe it's her second title. And previously had been, I think it was a 250. So why not start your second title run with a 1000? It'll be interesting to see what will come next for her, because now her rankings in the top 15, having kind of pulled off this remarkable win, she's going to get better draws. She's going to be playing against the top players much more regularly. And she kind of escaped playing the top players on her way through this draw. So there still is a big question mark about how she will match up against, you know, the Iga Swiatek she mentioned, the Coco Gauffs, because Kalinskaya did it the hard way. I mean, she was the giant slayer of the week. She took out Ostapenko, Goff, Świątek, and then she was serving for it, I believe, or it was on her racket and she didn't quite get it. So I think that it's taking your chances for Paolini against a player who had never been there before. Let her get the win. But at the same time, I have to say, player of the week, I'm not sure it would be Paolini. I think for me, it might be Kalinskaya.
Yeah, Kalinskaya, 6-4, 3-1. She was up in that final. She served for the match at 5-4. She didn't get a match point, but, you know, really disappointing for her. She must be absolutely ruining the kind of lead that she let slip. And, you know, she did also extremely well at the Australian Open. Was she semi-finalist?
Quarter-finalist,
yeah. So, you know, continuing her run of good form this season. Yeah, Joel, what did you make of Kalinskaya? I mean, what do you think was the kind of the key difference really in that final that Paolini was able to just kind of keep going and you know, what that last set, that the closing stages of the match, what was it that Paolini did to get over the finish line?
I think it was more, you know, Kalinskaya, I think, certainly got a touch nervous, I think. You know, it was almost a situation where both players in a very unexpected moment in a WTA 1000 final, and it felt in that very final part of that third set, who was going to handle their nerves best? And Kalinskaya, sad to say, it almost sort of just kind of fell apart from her, because Paolini really kind of grabbed the momentum. She won 16 of the last 19 points, sprinted through those last four games, and you know, took the match. So I'd say with Kalinskaya, maybe her nerves let her down a little bit towards the end, but at the same time, Paolini, I mean, she's just battled through round after round, you know, this tournament. You know, had Admire, she was a set, and it almost looked like she was, you know, on the verge of going out. Sorana Cassaer as well in the semi-finals, she had to save 6 set points in the second set before coming through in a tie break. And I think that's just been the story of her tournament. She's just had unbelievable mentality, strong belief, strong desire to win, and that has seen her through where some of her opponents like Kalinskaya have not been able to get it over the finish line.
I just want to ask a question here to both of you, because we were not predicting that Iga would come into Dubai and not bring the form that she had previously. It was such an out of sorts Iga, and I saw the statistic. This is 343 days since her last straight sets loss, which is very impressive. But I was watching most of that match and it looked like her forehand broke down, but I think Kalinskaya was just hitting the cover off the ball and straight down the middle. That backhand was really being hit hard. And do you think that is still the way to beat Iga? It's just to absolutely pummel the ball at her, take the time away and see if she lifts off the ball and starts kind of pushing it out the back, because it looked like she just followed the game plan and it worked.
I think for me, Kalinskaya in that match, she was also very calm and composed, and she didn't let Świątek and her bag of tricks, I think, faze her. And I think that actually got under, you know, Świątek's skin. And I think there was times where I was almost expecting Świątek to change it up from the baseline, you know, whether that was coming to the net, bringing some drop shots, change tactics. And it didn't really happen. And that's what I felt kind of with Kalinskaya, that she was just able to stay calm and composed. And, you know, Świątek wasn't willing to adapt or change. And that, I think, fell into Kalinskaya's hands.
I mean, Kalinskaya coming through Coco Gauff and Iga Świątek. So she really was the giant killer of the week. Where do you think she can go from here? I mean, what do you expect to see from Kalinskaya over the next kind of few weeks? Are we picking her to potentially pick up, you know, could she get to another final of the one of the upcoming 1000 events, do we think?
I think her game
she
is
win it next time.
She has the game, and I think she showed us that Australia quarterfinal wasn't a flash in the pan, that she really can play at this level. And I think she surprised a lot of people, and as Joel said, it didn't look like she surprised herself really, because she was so calm in those key moments against the top players. But then I guess winning the title is another sort of kettle of fish when it gets to that point. But really solid backhand. She takes the ball so early. Her serve was playing, I mean, it was very much better than I have ever thought it would be. And I think it reminds me a little bit of like Joe Konta, in the sense that, you know, she's a little bit more mature when she's making her breakthrough, in the sense that this isn't a 19-year-old. It's someone who we didn't necessarily think would reach this stage based on the form book previously. And something has just switched. So I think it must be the mental side of the game, because clearly she's great, great technique. She's able to play tennis to a very high standard. So if she can keep the mindset, why can't she go top 20, maybe even top 15 by end of year?
I mean, to think she had to qualify, you know, for this event, and she was very much very, very close to, I think, becoming one of the, I think, the first ever qualifier to win a WTA 1000 event, which is truly, truly wild. But yeah, maybe those matches just caught up with her potentially at the end in the final, because that three set match, it was just, it went on, and the longer it went on, as I say, kind of Paolini with that mindset, it sort of kind of went her way in the end.
Yeah, Paolini also was the beneficiary of a walkover over Rybakina, which might have meant she was just that bit fresher as it got to the latter stages of the final. But, you know, full credit to her, into the top 15, biggest win of her career. Well done, Paolini. Just a note on Sabalenka. This was her first match back in Dubai since winning the Australian Open. She opened against Donna Vekic in the first round and lost. And not just any old loss. She was bageled in that third set. What did you make of Sabalenka kind of and her performance? It's not the way she would have wanted to have kind of returned to the tour, is it?
No, it wasn't. I think, to be honest, it's not too surprising when you look at it, given the fact that this did happen last year as well in a very similar format. She lost early in Dubai. So I think we weren't expecting her to lose so early, especially because she has a very good draw. We thought we were going to see some, you know, some clashes between maybe a Rybakina, Sabalenka semi-final potentially. But I mean, it's a long time since she's played. And a long time since she's had that victory, and it's completely different conditions, and you have to get, you know, it's a muscle you've got to continue to work out. So I think she's got to get herself back on the tour more regularly again. And I'm sure that we've seen this, you know, she's been bageled at the start of the year against Rybakina, and then she picked up herself up and she won a Grand Slam. So I don't think anyone's particularly worried about it, but it does seem like Vekic might be a bit of a bogeywoman for her.
The head-to-head is Donna Vekic 6, Arina Sabalenka 2. And I always thought that, you know, a stone had been turned, perhaps, in this rivalry. And we were going to see Sabalenka come out with a victory against, you know, Vekic in this match. But it wasn't the case. I mean, what is it about Donna Vekic, do you think, that Arina Sabalenka just has such a hard time with?
Ooh, I think it's probably the fact that Vekic does love a hard ball. I think when she's generating her own pace, she makes a lot more mistakes, and you see her lose some matches. I mean, 6-1, 6-1 against players who are a lot craftier on the court, and she can kind of beat herself at times. So I think probably Sabalenka is a combination of Sabalenka doesn't like to be rushed, Vekic likes the pace, and, you know, if you catch Sabalenka on a day where she's making a few more unforced errors than winners, it gives Vekic a great opportunity to get a win. So I think it must be that sort of a matchup side of things more than it is to do with the fact that Vekic plays like particularly well. She is a big match player anyway. But I mean, I was surprised because she has had some very topsy-turvy results this year, Vekic. So not so surprised by the head-to-head, but surprised by this result. And a bagel to finish was really surprising for me.
I mean, Vekic, we know she's a bit of a princess of the grass courts as well. So I wonder if some of those wins had come out on the lawns. But let's continue in the Middle East, because we also had the Doha event on the ATP side of things, which was a 250. And this was won by Karen Khachanov in the end, 7-6, 6-4 over a bit of a surprise finalist, I suppose, Jakub Mensik of the Czech Republic, he had quite a few big wins over the course of the week. But yeah, Khachanov is the champion. I mean, he hadn't won a title, I think, since last September, so he's picked up another one. It's his 6th ATP title in total, which actually, I don't know if that's surprising or not. I felt like he might have picked up maybe a couple more as he's been around for quite a while. But he didn't face a seeded player en route, so quite a comfortable week for him in total. Perhaps more interestingly, I suppose, Jakub Mensik. What do we know about Mensik? Because I have to say, I'd not really seen much of him before this week. I know he's a next-genner, isn't he, Joel?
Yeah, he's a very, very handy player and a very bright player, I think, for the future. I was watching a few videos, a few interviews of him. He's spoken about Novak Djokovic being his inspiration. And you can see in terms of the way he plays his game, he's a handful, you know, for the big big players, experienced players. He shows no fear. And I think that's what you need, you know, at this stage, particularly when you're coming up against such stalwarts of the game like Gael Monfils, Andy Murray as well. Although I do think Andy Murray probably should have won that match. But he just is very aggressive, I think, from the baseline. He has a lot of good shots. Doesn't feel like he's got any obvious weaknesses. And yeah, it's just, you know, for me, this is almost kind of his breakout tournament. And although he wasn't able to get it done in the final, considering the names he took out to get there, it was very, very impressive. And maybe quite similar to Callan Skyer in terms of the caliber of names he took out en route, but just not able to get it over the finish line.
Yeah, he's up to 87 in the rankings now. So he's in the top 100 where he's debuted now. And like you said, he had a real battle against Andy Murray in the second round. Three tie breaks it was. A bit gutting for you, Joel, and other Murray fans,
I'm volley,
sure.
That backhand volley at the net on set point in that first set that he went on to lose. I'm still having nightmares about it, I think.
Yeah, a bit of a shame. We know Murray's lost quite a few long battles, you know, 3 and a bit hours. It's tough.
It does tend to make you think, though, that when Murray has these losses, everyone writes, Murray, worst loss of career. And then fast forward, he takes out Rublev in straight sets and then pushes Khachanov all the way in the final. So it does put a bit of perspective that we shouldn't necessarily be kind of jumping to conclusions, because when you look at that in the light of the rest of the tournament, I mean, he took out a top 10 player in Andrei Rublev, who's someone who has previously won in Doha before. So I think that does definitely give it a bit of a different perspective.
It softens the blow.
It does.
It softens the blow, definitely.
Absolutely.
It does. It seems like beating Murray is almost like the catalyst for people to suddenly have the week of their life, or playing Murray seems to be. But I mean, what great prospects he has. I mean, he's 18. And he's already kind of putting together such great results on the tour. And he pushed, I think it was pushed Hurkacz to 5 sets at the Australian Open. So he's definitely working his way up, and I'm sure his ranking will only continue to rise.
Yeah, and in the final against Khachanov, that first set, it was, you know, went, what, 14-12 on the tiebreak, you know. So, you know, Khachanov had to save 4 set points. It was really close. I mean, it could have, you know, if he'd caught that first set, Mensik, you know, could have gone all the way and won the title.
Khachanov loves winning a tiebreak 14-12, because he did that in the first set against Popperin in the semi-final.
He's not
mentally
rock solid.
Yeah,
he doesn't, does he? But I mean, it's quite impressive, because he did serve 16 aces, Jakub did. So, I mean, to win a tiebreak against someone who's serving that many aces, I mean, that is quite the feat. That's almost like when Hurkacz loses, like, loses matches 7-6, 7-6, 6-7 or whatever it would be, but didn't even face a break point. So I guess the work that I would say has to be done would be off the ground rather than off the serve. It seems like probably playing against these top players, they are just that bit better from the baseline right now. So that would be an area where, I mean, he's 18, there's so much room for improvement and time to improve. One question I was just going to ask Kim on this. So we've talked a lot about Alcaraz and where he is kind of on the form side of things, but now we've got this another gen coming up. So have we got new gen, next gen, current gen and future gen, and then we've got, you know, the big three? How do we make sense of all of this now when we go through these things?
And we've got babies who are like next
I know,
gen.
I know.
Toddlers.
We need a code for it.
It's like the multiverse. It's like a multiverse. Generation,
it's like
multiverse.
A pyramid. Yeah. Measure your height against the wall.
I mean, one of my favourite comments, as you know, that I saw on social media last year when Wimbledon was having those issues with what round people were playing, and, you know, because of the delays, and it was all, the draw was all screwed. It was no rounds, just vibes, which made me laugh. So maybe it could just be like no gens, just vibes. No ages, just vibes.
No gens, just vibes. I like that.
I don't care how old people are. I'm just going to want them to play on the tennis
court. Why don't, just radical idea here, let's like take a Grand Slam and categorize players by the generation they're in and make that each quarter.
Ooh,
so we can get,
so we
like,
definitely get some multi-generational clashes.
Yes.
The best of the mid-gen.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm doing.
Okay.
I mean, are we bringing back, you know, like Rod Laver?
Yeah,
maybe not that much.
How generational are we going?
We'll have a generational alternate.
Okay,
right. I mean, talking about someone who I guess will be soon maybe going into the retired generation, Andy Murray today. He's in Dubai for this week's tournament. He's beaten Denis Shapovalov. But he did mention today that he probably doesn't have too long left, but he's going to do as best as he can these last few months. So I'm paraphrasing him there. But Joel, big Murray fan, I know. Do you think that he's really indicating now that he's planning to maybe retire at Wimbledon?
I mean, it sounds that way. I mean, it was an incredible result against Shapovalov today. 500 wins now on hard courts. But as a Murray fan, you can't help but notice in that interview, he's now put a time frame potentially on when his tennis is coming to an end. And, you know, with that, it does sound like the British grass court season could be his last hurrah. It wouldn't necessarily surprise me. I just wonder whether Wimbledon will be his final event and he's been playing all these matches just to get to that point, as opposed to he's going to play another season. We'll have to wait and see. But it does sound like the grass court season could be, I say, that sort of last moment to see some Murray magic on a tennis court.
Yeah, soak it all up while you can. Let's have a look at what happened out in South America on the Golden Swing last year, because we did have the Rio Open, which is an ATP 500 event. This one last year was where Cameron Norrie beat Carlos Alcaraz in the final. But this year, 2024, neither of them got there. Alcaraz going out to Thiago Monteiro. I mean, I say going out, he retired after two games, so make of that what you will. Cameron Norrie getting beaten in the semi-final by Mariano Navone, an Argentinian qualifier. So that wasn't great. But it was ultimately won by Sebastian Baez in the end, who came across Navone in the final 6-2, 6-1. It was quite one-sided in terms of the scoreline. So he picked up his fifth title of his career and his biggest title to date at this 500 level. Chris, what did you make of the action in Rio? Sebastian Baez, surprised by that, or perhaps more surprised by Navone, the qualifier, getting there?
Well, to be honest, I think I'm just a bit surprised that, you know, we didn't have Alcaraz making a deep run and we didn't have Norrie making a deep run, because, I mean, last year's Golden Swing was basically, you know, the Norrie-Alcaraz show where they were just kind of trading titles. So they really haven't made an impact this time. So I think my big takeout is I'm very pleased with Baez in this, because he's a player who has quite a different background from a lot of the Argentinian players. He didn't come from much at all. He worked very, very hard. He's a real grifter in terms of how much he does play on the tour, how many tournaments he plays, and he didn't have the sort of funding that like the Echeverries and the Cerundolos had. And actually, what I think is kind of interesting is some of these results, when he plays against an Argentinian, he does rather well, because, I mean, it's straight sets against all of the Argentinians he faced, and he does say, unlike the other Argentinians, he thinks that friendship doesn't always help, it can be a hindrance. So that's very different from the Argentinian attitude, and maybe that's why he's kind of on this path where he is getting these titles in a way that the other Argentinians aren't really able to emulate, because I think you said five titles already, and of players active at the moment, I mean, that's right up there, and the biggest being a 500. So he's definitely maxing out on his talent and his potential.
Yeah, he's only 22 and he's got five titles, so I think. So that, you know, he's still pretty young, isn't he? So, but yeah, and obviously Navone, his the first time he would have been in this position. So he had a great week coming through, beating Norrie. I mean, that was quite a comprehensive defeat, 6-4, 6-2 over Norrie. And Norrie had been kind of going through relatively comfortably up to that point.
I watched some of that, Kim. Norrie did not look himself during that match. I wondered actually at some points if he was going to withdraw or retire, because it did look like he was ill. I don't know if he'd had something dodgy to eat or what it was, but he was just not at the races at all.
Yeah. And what do we know about Alcaraz? You know, 10 minutes into his match, retired. What's the situation there? Should we be worried?
Rolling your ankle 10 minutes into a tennis match is just not what you want. And it just feels like at the moment with Alcaraz, when it rains, it pours. You know, he's not been in great form. You know, he's not been playing the tennis we all know that he's capable of. And, you know, to add in an injury to your ankle, that it does look like he's going to play in Indian Wells. So not as bad as it could have been. But at the same time, it's just another disruption on a season that he wants no disruptions.
It's going to be really tricky this next period for him. And I really am not sure if he's going to be in the top 10 kind of by the end of the year necessarily, because, I mean, if you look at it from a ranking points perspective alone, he's dropped a lot of points in the Golden Swing already. And then now coming up, he's got some big points. I mean, he's got to defend, or try and defend Indian Wells. He also had a semi-final in Miami last year. He won in Barcelona. He won in Madrid. You know, then we keep going semi-finals of the French. He then had the victory at Queens and the victory at Wimbledon. Finals of Cincinnati. Like, he was playing top two tennis, top one tennis at times last year. So I do think it's going to be a bit of a rethink, because Juan Carlos Ferreira was talking about the fact that when he is playing, he's not tactically working it out in the way that he has done previously. And I think if you're not figuring it out, then that's actually, doesn't matter how you can play the tennis. We know how mental the game is. And it's the problem solving that I think he's done such a good job of previously. So I don't know. What do we think? Top 10 by the end of the year? Or do you think that maybe, I think something might happen. Maybe he'll be out for a bit of time and then he'll come back again. I think he obviously will be back at the top, but I'm not convinced right now.
I think he can be in the top 10 at the end of the year, but I do think, yeah, he's going to go down, and I don't think he's going to defend all those points. But I think it's almost, maybe he just needs this time after his standout season last year, whereby he regroups and he comes back and he works on, you know, the areas that we know he needs to improve on.
Is he too good for the Golden Swing? Is a question I would ask. I mean, I know last week we spoke about how Rafa started off, you know, getting clay court titles on the Golden Swing in South America. Is it the right play for Alcaraz to go out there and do these tournaments, do you think?
I think it's for the paycheck, if I'm honest. He gets paid an awful lot to go there. We're talking...
$900,000, wasn't it, I think, for Buenos Aires.
So imagine what it might be in Rio. So I think he still did fulfill quite a lot of his commitments as well. In Rio as well. So I think it's more about following the money. And I think we'll talk about this a bit more in the second half, but he's certainly following the money by playing the Netflix slam.
Yes, more of that later. Before we go to a break, we did also have the Los Cabos event in Mexico, which is the ATP 250 event. This one was a kind of also full of surprises, but very fun week for a certain someone. That's Jordan Thompson taking home the title 6-3, 7-6 over Casper Ruud in the final. Jordan Thompson, well, he had to play, I think, three matches on the last day alone, came back various times across the course of the week. I mean, it's a real dramatic turnaround in his fortunes. I don't know really where to start, but what an effort from him, because, it's been dubbed a bit of a miracle week for Jordan Thompson. I mean, I guess to start with, in the quarterfinal, he was down 6-love, 3-love against Alex Michelson. Turned that one around, was down in his semi-final against Sasha Zverev as well, and then was also, well, not down against Ruud, but just, yeah, had a bit of a battle to cap it off. But then, yeah, had to play two doubles matches on the final day as well to win both of those, won the doubles and the singles down in Los Cabos. I'm tired just talking about it. I can't imagine how shattered he must have felt after the
But what
final
a feeling. What
match.
A feeling. I mean, your first ever ATP Tour singles title. I mean, he's been battling on the way on the tour for a while now. And I think this is just rewards. And, you know, to think that he was so close to going out in that quarterfinal. I think he himself said that he thought he was going to be double bageled.
It was 6-love and all points for 5-1.
Yeah, like, yeah, it was.
That's so different, isn't it? It's turned that around.
We were going to be talking about him in a completely different light, yeah. It felt like at that moment. But to consider the run he went on from there to the final, and then to get that win in straight sets over Casper Ruud, and I think he finished at like 3 a.m. local time to win the doubles trophy as well. It's very special, I think, when you win your first ever singles title on the tour, but to win singles and doubles, that is a very, very impressive feat.
I felt a bit bad for Casper, though, because he was beaten in both finals, because Casper made a doubles final of all things, which yes. is quite surprising. Yes. So, I mean, that's a double dose of defeat that he had to take against at the hands of Jordan Thompson, which you think he might get one of them, one of the two, but Jordan was not in a particularly generous mood. I don't think he lost a set in the semifinals or the finals of the doubles or in the finals. So it's a great result. And I found out the last time this happened, would you like to hazard a guess who last won the singles and doubles on the tour?
Yes. I think I've got it.
Is it? Yeah, I know. I was thinking this as she went on to say
it. Oh, you know
it.
Come on then.
Well, I was going to... Well, I don't know. Joel, do you want to say or shall I?
Give him the glory. Go on, Joel.
I could be completely wrong, but maybe this is why Kim's asking me. I want to say Andy Murray won the Tokyo Open against Rafa and he won the doubles with Jamie Murray.
But that's way long ago.
Is that
right? What year are you talking about?
I think that happened. Maybe it wasn't the last time it happened. I don't think it happens that often though.
Is it not Feliciano Lopez at Queens in 2019?
Ooh.
It's probably neither.
Is that I think it's Washington. Oh, 2022. Okay. And
right.
Any more guesses? You've really gone old school, you guys.
Absolutely.
You've just gone for your faves. Spaniards and Brits here. It was...
Yannick Sinner?
It was Nick Kyrgios who did it.
Oh.
Yeah, so...
with Kokkinakis?
Australians. Kokkinakis? They clearly love...
I'm not sure who he did it with, but yeah, Australians. Something about the Australians. Multi-talented nation.
I mean, I did also have to look up the doubles that with Casper Ruud. I thought, oh... He doesn't normally get to the semis of the doubles, but he was playing with William Blumberg. So there we go. But yeah, not to be. Well done, Jordan Thompson. What a way to get your first singles title on the tour and get another doubles title. So yeah, fantastic stuff. Let's take a very quick break now, but do join us in the second half where we'll be discussing the upcoming Netflix Slam in Las Vegas, as we've alluded to. We'll be looking at Holger Rune returning to Patrick Mouratoglou's coaching camp and also looking at how we would perhaps upgrade the Golden Swing in South America. So do not go anywhere.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at Burrow.com/ACAST. That's Burrow.com/ACAST. Burrow.com/ACAST.
Welcome back to the Tennis Weekly podcast. And now we're going to move on to a mysterious player.
The return.
We haven't done this for a while.
Oh, I love
it
these.
Has returned. We haven't forgotten
about
it.
Much better than Joel's game. I can't remember what Joel's game is, but I know I wasn't good at it.
Oh, yeah, we had a new game, didn't we? But
we'll be bringing that back, don't worry. Okay.
Get that one out of the box soon, Joel's game. Right, I've got one for both you and, both of you and our listeners. So you'll have to fight it out amongst yourselves as to who's going to
get in. Yes, they can play along at home, can't they? Pens and papers at the ready.
Yes. So, right, I'm going to read out a succession of clues and we'll see how you all get on. Chris, I know once upon a time you did get the first clue, which was usually someone's birthday. So I'll be very surprised if you get this person
too long
based
on Wikipedia.
Their birthday. Okay, right. Mysterious player. I was born on the 7th of August, 1997.
Ooh.
Interesting.
So probably still playing at the moment.
I should hope so, yeah.
Who's going to go first, Chris?
You can pick, Kim, who goes first.
Oh, Joel, you go first, because you look like you're struggling. being me.
I'm going to go with Hugo Delian.
That's not actually that bad a shout, really. But no, it's not Hugo Delian.
I'll go for Francis Tiafoe.
Incorrect. Not there just yet. So, next clue is quite a general one, but potentially important. I play right-handed with a two-handed backhand. So,
well, that narrows it down.
Some
yeah.
people.
I'm just going to say the same guess, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Adrian Mannarino. Oh, no, it's not going to be Adrian Mannarino. He's too old.
No, he's not that young.
I'm going to say Francisco Cerundolo.
Incorrect. Anything else from you, Chris, or shall I proceed?
Well, I've got to give it a guess, haven't I? I'll go Andre Rublev.
Incorrect. My highest career ranking is number 36.
Oh, God. Kim.
Oh, this is right in Chris's sweet spot.
36. That is not great.
Could be, is it a female player as well?
I know, you always assume it's a man on this game.
No, because it's really hard to
know. I just assume it's a Spanish male player. That's what I go with. Like, and then I'm going to work my way up to it. I wish we could ask questions, Joel.
Yulia Putintseva.
No, it's not Putintseva.
That would be truly iconic if that was what you got. Well, and that's, so we need a 26-year-old right-hander. 36, that's very specific, isn't it? I can't think of anyone who would have had a career high. Maybe it's a double specialist. Oh, I have no idea. I'll just go Taylor Townsend. I have no idea.
Incorrect. Okay, next clue. I made my Grand Slam debut at the 2021 Australian Open after I qualified and reached the second round.
Second round. It could be a double specialist. I'm going to say Storm Saunders.
Incorrect.
Qualified and made the second round. I'll go for... I actually have no idea. I'm going to pass. I literally am passing because we're not getting closer, are we, Joel?
Okay. I reached the semi-finals of the 2022 ATP Cup after winning two singles and three doubles matches with my teammate, Daniil Medvedev.
Oh, my God. I think...
Right, so you know it's a bloke.
This is... You've carved out a horrific mysterious player. It was, people said bring back mysterious player. Now they won't be.
Impossible player.
Russian player. I think I know who it is.
I think I did as well.
Do we? I think we have to say it on the same count because otherwise...
Oh, do we?
Ooh.
Yeah, okay. Shall I count you in? On the count of three, when it gets to three, you say the okay. name. Okay, so one, two, three.
Roman
Aslan Karatsev.
Oh, he said something different. So just for the purposes
Aslan's
of doubt.
Aslan's been
Joel
higher than 36.
Joel said Aslan Karatsev.
Oh, yeah, he has.
Joel says Karatsev. He has. Chris has said Safulin.
Oh, I think Chris is right.
If I give you the next
oh,
clue.
Oh, tell us the next cue. Come on.
I reached the quarterfinals of Wimbledon in 2023.
Oh, it is Roman Safulin.
It is Roman Safulin.
Oh,
well
no.
done, Chris.
Oh, no.
That was the hardest one we've ever done.
Ooh. Do you know where I got my inspiration from? I was away for the weekend with some friends.
With Roman.
And,
maybe it was a Roman site you were at.
My friend said, oh, who's that Russian tennis player? I've been following them since Wimbledon last year. And I said, oh, well, I don't know who you mean. And they couldn't remember his name. And then they did a bit of a Google and they went, oh, it's Safulin. And I was like, oh, right, okay. And so then
making
hence,
waves
he became my
amongst your friends,
mysterious
Kim.
Player. Mm,
fair enough.
Making waves amongst my friends who don't really follow tennis.
It's not
so
done much
yes,
since, has he?
Famous. No, not an awful lot, but had a win over Alcaraz, I think, last year as well. So
he's getting the wins here
I think
and
in
there.
Paris,
then.
He got a win, yeah, over Alcaraz. So he's had a few upset wins, but you know, but his highest ranking of 36 was in January of this year. Oh, so watch this space.
Exactly. Well, listeners have to let us know, did you get it from the first clue? And if you did, we will send you a t-shirt. Not a t-shirt, we'll send you a tote bag.
Yes. Yeah. We'll send you everything.
Everything we have.
Have you memorized every ATP player's birthday?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's a new quiz, ATP birthdays.
Well, let's have a look what's in the Tennis Weekly mailbag this week. We've had David get in touch with us on email. And David has asked us, he said, hi, Tennis Weekly. With Andy Murray this week on social media saying that South America should have its own dedicated swing plus a Masters Series event, what changes would you make to improve the Golden Swing? So thanks very much, David, for getting in contact with us. And he's referring to a tweet by Andy Murray, which Andy was sort of expressing the fact that the Golden Swing have incredible tournaments and fans, amazing atmospheres. It's a big part of their sporting culture. And that, you know, they should really have much more kind of credit given to them for that and rewarded with their own Masters Series, perhaps. So what do you guys think? Do you agree with Andy Murray? Do you think more could be made of this phase in the calendar?
Well, we were at, obviously, Buenos Aires with Alina there, and she said that they've been applying for years to be a 500, and it really does have the feel of a 500 size-wise based on the different tournaments that we've been to and that she's been to. And so it feels like they aren't upgrading it because Rio's not being upgraded. So it almost feels like you should upgrade Rio and then you can upgrade Argentina, and then it makes it a lot more kind of I guess more incentive for the players to go down and play there. And I think the other thing I would do, and this could be very unpopular, and Murray did say that this could be an unpopular opinion, but I really don't have much time for these US 250s where it is just, you know, it's just the Americans who don't necessarily want to travel at that time, and they're already going to be playing, you know, in Indian Wells and Miami. And I think you don't really need to have them competing and kind of taking some of those players away from the clay, because seeing different players like Cam Norrie playing the Golden Swing, I think it's actually a very interesting prospect, seeing players in a different situation, a different environment you've never seen them in before. So I would say yes. And I think a lot of the players do always want to make sure that they go back and play it before they retire. Like Stan said that to Alina in press, that, you know, he wanted one more final Golden Swing, and you just think it's something special down there. So I think it more than deserves it.
Yeah, it feels like the Golden Swing as a fan, it's like almost like in bucket list territory, I think. You know, the events, you see it on TV, the atmosphere doesn't look like anything else on the tour. And, you know, seeing all the fans at the Buenos Aires event, it just shows that there is a real appetite for tennis out there. And it's almost a shame that they can't cap it, I think, with a Masters 1000 event. And, you know, if that is, I think that should be the case. And I think it should be kind of the what everything is kind of leading up to, because it doesn't feel to me like there is anything that they're kind of leading to, because we have this, you know, 500 event in Rio, that's great, but the week after we've got kind of like the Chile Open, I think, which is another 250. So it doesn't to me feel like there's any sense of building towards something. And I think that's a kind of a missed opportunity. So I do wonder whether, you know, there is kind of potential to maybe make Buenos Aires a 500 and have Rio maybe as a Masters 1000 event, get some players out there who might pass at it, because there's not enough ranking points available. And as you said, Chris, get these players in these environments where it is rowdy.
It's like a Davis Cup match.
You have wild cards and qualifiers, you know, playing out of their skin, going deep in draws.
It's almost defeat the Argentinians.
Yeah, it just creates very unique and interesting matchups. Like, we still talk about the Alcaraz-Norrie match at Rio from last year, and it's those sorts of like matchups I'd love to see like a lot more out there, because it's just such a unique proposition.
Yeah, I think it would be fun to have a Masters event there. I think that would make sense for it to build up to something. And I think, I mean, not every other tournament has a train that goes past, you know, looking over the stand, which I thought that's just one like quirky thing I loved about it. And I think it would give it much more, I think it would give it the credit that it deserves. So I agree with Andy Murray as well. So we're pretty much in a consensus.
Popular opinion
there,
than
guys?
Andy Murray.
Popular opinion. He thinks it's an unpopular opinion. I think he didn't think it would go down well if it was suggested to the powers that be.
We'll
perhaps
put it on our Twitter. We'll do a poll and see what you guys say.
Well, let's have a look now at the Netflix slam, which is still going ahead, we believe. It's, well, I'm a bit kind of confused as to what it is, to be honest with you. I've seen various things.
It's the Netflix slam, Kim.
It's self-explanatory.
It's an exhibition in Las
Winner
Vegas.
Winner gets a subscription to Netflix for a year.
Yeah, that's the prize.
Broadcast, is it broadcast on Netflix?
It's streaming live, yeah, it is indeed.
Oh, right, okay. And it's on March the 3rd at the Mandalay Bay, which is a hotel in Vegas.
These are all correct. Right. You're very confused, Kim.
Well, I mean, there's astronomical amounts of money being floated around as part of this. I think, obviously, Rafa's going to be there. Alcaraz is going to be there. Apparently, they're charging vast fortunes of money for private tennis sessions as part of the general event. I mean, they've got various players also involved. Taylor Fritz, Francis Tiafoe, John Isner and Sam Querrey are there as well. It's slightly less exciting. But
could you imagine getting a training session with John Isner and Sam Querrey just blasting like 140 mile an hour?
They're not doing serves, are they? Imagine if they're doing something else. Like,
I'd want a refund if it was the serve practice.
Well, you're paying $2,000 per person for them, but it's $50,000 per person for Nadal and Alcaraz.
But that's a group. The private session for Rafa or Charlie is $150,000. That is mad money. I mean, I'd hope that I improved in that time. I mean, I better come out with Rafa's backhand or Rafa's forehand as well if you're paying that much money. Would you pay that, Kim?
No, absolutely not. I don't have that sort of money.
We'll do a crowdfunder.
Are we going to see more of these sorts of events, do you think? Are they sort of taking over?
The thing that I don't understand or I'm not loving is the kind of more flagrant uses we're seeing in exhibitions of the word slam. It feels like that term should be protected more to the four grand slams that exist. And shouldn't just be used like as a marketing opportunity,
like a loophole. When they talk about the Super Bowl, you have to say the big game, but it seems like no one owns Slam, so they can get away with it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I don't like how other people can kind of come in and just say Slam, and we're sort of meant to believe that. So I don't like it from that perspective. But we're seeing like exhibition events crop up more and more. It doesn't surprise me, particularly with what Netflix have been doing with Breakpoint, for example. But should these players be playing it? I'm not sure, particularly at the moment where Alcaraz, with his ankle injury at Rio, is this the wisest option? Rafa as well. I guess it makes more sense from him because this is a bit of match practice coming back for the Indian Wells. But there's a part of me that's kind of like, there's no real need to play this, is there?
It did seem a bit cursed, didn't it? As soon as that happened, when obviously Rafa then pulled out of the Australian Open and then now Carlos has obviously got injured. And when there's big money on the line, I guess you still have to turn up and then probably play at 50%, which is obviously not what people are paying for. But I'd argue the sort of people who are going to see this is broader than the normal tennis audience and probably are going more because they're such big fans of these players. So I think we'll see more of it. It makes you kind of... It begs the question, before UTS, there's always a fun game where they all play together. Maybe that will start to be monetized in a different way. And maybe that's the future of how some of this stuff is going. But I'm not sure that many of these are looking to get into coaching whilst they're still active players. It's a bit strange in that sense.
Tickets are $485 starting at that, plus fees and what have you. So it's not for the everyday person, but thankfully we'll be able to watch it on Netflix, I suppose. So hurrah for that. We'll see how it is.
Joel, you can review it for us and explain to Kim what happened.
Yes.
I just need to work out the time zone because it's in Vegas. I mean, Formula One's gone to Vegas now. They're obviously Vegas are trying to get a lot more sport going there, I suppose. So we'll see how it goes. We're not going to knock it till we've watched it. We'll share our opinions, I guess. Well, once it's happened, but exciting to see Rafa back. If it happens,
could be Isner
we'll
versus
see.
Query and playing in front of a Vegas audience.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
And in other news, we've had some updates from Holger Rune, who has announced that he has reunited with Patrick Mouratoglou, and he will become his full-time coach. with immediate effect. So they did part ways last season, and Runa has since worked with Boris Becker and also Severin Luthi. But Mouratoglou is back, and they've known each other for years, Runa being part of the sort of academy and foundation. Chris, you know, we know you're quite a big Holger Runa follower, especially being based in Denmark. What do you make of this latest from his camp?
It's definitely not a surprise, because throughout the entire time, the performance analyst, Mike James, was working with him, and he works for the Mouratoglou Academy. So Mouratoglou always retained a presence in his camp. A lot of the sort of the narrative that's been the rhetoric that's been used about someone who really knows him. So I think people were looking at, oh, is he going to go back to maybe his childhood coach like he's talked about, or will it still be Kenneth Carlson? But no, he's gone back to Patrick. And I think a lot of us thought this would be coming. I think it's when it was first announced, we weren't sure about it. When he first started working with him, and obviously it paid dividends, winning in Stockholm and then obviously getting kind of the result of his career so far against Novak Djokovic in Paris. So they did have a very successful record. They did make Masters finals last year before they split. And it does feel like that this is the right way to be going. And I think it's quite positive, because he did break with his existing management, with his mother, and now he is with IMG. And it feels like this is a much more solid base that he has, being part of that system, than it would be kind of having all these different other coaches involved. Because I don't know how you'd manage the egos in that camp before now. But I put the question to you, Joel. Should he have ever hired Boris, especially knowing Boris could never travel with him to lots of places?
Yeah, the whole Holger Rune team situation, it feels like he's not really stuck with kind of one thing. There's been a lot of flip-flopping and coming back to Patrick Mouratoglou. It just reminds me of that, you know, Friends episode of like Ross and Rachel, and like we were on a break. Yeah. And it's like, to me, it's almost like that. And I don't think you
who's
can...
Ross and who's Rachel in this?
Yeah. Good question. But I don't think you can't reach the top of your game, I don't think, without a stable support team behind you. And he's just not, it feels like, had that over the last 6 to 12 months or so. And that is what has felt like has been holding him back. So if this thing gives him that stability, having Mouratoglou back gives him that stability, I think it can be a good thing. Having said that, because of the way it sort of flip-flopped in the past, I'm still like, the jury's out in terms of how long maybe this is going to last. And it's one of those things that I think can bear fruit, and it can push Holger, you know, to places he hasn't been before. But he needs that stability, and I think you're only going to get that with time.
Yeah, and I mean, he does have a large number of points actually to defend with, from, you know, Acapulco sort of through to Wimbledon. So it might well be that on paper it looks like this partnership doesn't work immediately, because he might be dropping down a bit. It all depends. But I think the latter half of the season he has a lot less to defend, so that might be where the real inroads are happening.
And he does talk about he wants a slam. I think he doesn't really care about these other tournaments now, so I'd like to see him play less and get himself into some of those later stages, because he's got big ambitions, he's got big talent, and he's just spreading himself too thin. So hopefully, you know, Patrick, when he worked with Serena was not playing week in, week out on the tour. She didn't need to. And I think, I'm not comparing their talent level as being the same at all, but I'm saying that you can set yourself up like Jannik Sinner did by not playing a lead-up event for the AO and performing very well. So I think he needs to learn that time on court doesn't mean time well spent always.
Less can be more. Well, let's have a look at what's happening this week on the tour. We've got a hat trick of hard court 500s this week. We've got ATP out in Dubai and Acapulco, the WTA in San Diego. And we've also got a couple of 250s. We've got the ATP Chile Open and the WTA ATX Open in Austin. Do you have any particular events that you're looking forward to the most, either of you? Anything catching your eye that you're going to be tuning into this week?
For me, it's Dubai and Daniil Medvedev actually being the top seed there. When last time we saw him step out on a tennis court in that Australian Open final, it just ended in such a, you know, heartbreaking fashion for him. So I'm curious to see how he bounces back from that. in Dubai. I think he's got quite a nice opening draw against Shevchenko. Could face Chris, one of your favourites, Sumit Nagal.
Ooh, in, he's got a wild in card, the second hasn't he? Round. Well earned wild card. Yeah, I think that would be a good one.
So I'm curious to see how Daniil Medvedev gets on this week, I think.
I'm scrolling to find Sloane. She's playing somewhere. I've seen it. Number two
seed. Yeah, she's the second seed.
In Texas. Yeah, it hasn't got the biggest lineup there. But the other person I'm looking at will be Norrie switching to hardcourt. Can he reverse his fortune? And I think there'll be some questions that we're looking for answers for there. So I think that would be a good one to watch.
And Kim, are you excited about Roman Safulin versus Stefanos Tsitsipas in round one of Acapulco?
Well, now that we've mentioned Roman Safulin, I fully expect him to beat Tsitsipas.
It just says that on the draw. Tsitsipas versus mysterious player.
I mean, actually, I'm quite interested to see what JPEG is going to do in San Diego. Yeah. We haven't seen her back on court for a while. So, top seed there. What will we
Wozniacki just spotted her. Dollar Hyde, the big guns.
And I'm loving
Katie
the
Balter?
Current scoreline. Katie Balter, yeah. I'm loving the current scoreline as we're recording this in Dubai. Hubert Hurkacz has just beaten Jan Lennard Struff three tiebreaks.
Oh, yeah. What a surprise.
Last set tiebreak. Absolutely, completely predictable scoreline there from those two. So perhaps we'll have more of the same from him throughout the week. Nicholas Jarry is also the top seed out in Chile for the Chile Open. Sebastian Baez, second seed. You know, can he get another title? On the golden swing. And like you said, Texas as well, where we've got Danielle Collins in action. Perhaps she'll go deep in Texas. But that's it. We'll be back next week, a bit later, I think, than usual, to wrap up these events, but also to preview Indian Wells, because obviously that is a big, big tournament happening in the not too distant future.
Yes, very, very excited. The Sunshine Double is upon us very, very soon. So we're looking forward to that. But we're going to end our tour catch up there. A final plug for our Tennis Weekly survey. The link is in the description. Thank you everyone who has reached out and submitted their answers for the survey. Literally takes about 3 minutes. You don't have to sign up to anything, but would very much help us and help the podcast grow over 2024. So if you have some time, please do that. But we're going to end it there. Listeners, I hope you've enjoyed our latest episode of the Tennis Weekly podcast. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on all the action to come from the ATP and WTA tours.
We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all major podcasting platforms out there. And if you like what you're hearing, then do make sure to leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
You can also follow us on social media or email the show. And on social media, you can tell us on Instagram whether you think there should be a 1,000 as part of the Golden Swing. We'll put that up as well. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, and X. And the handle for all of those is Tennis Weekly Pod. You can also purchase our delightful Tennis Weekly merch at etsy.com/shop/tennisweeklypodcast. You can email us at tennisweeklypod@gmail.com or do check out our website, tennisweekly.co.uk.
And we will be back next week at Tennis Weekly HQ. So I hope you can join us for that. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Chris.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We'll see you again soon.